I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I was going to start this program by talking about the way that children react to lightning and thunder. We've all seen it, how the flash and the boom and the rumble frightens children, and how they start to think that something's wrong with the universe. And then their parents and teachers and then their peers teach them that what's going on in a storm is not that bad, and the explosions become part of a completely different story. I was going to talk about that because Howard Gardner uses this example to help us understand how the brain works. I was going to talk about it, but I changed my mind. I changed my mind because Gardner also uses an intriguing cast of figures from history and science to explain how our minds are changed, and that drew me in even further. So that's where we'll start, but we'd like to have you with us this hour. What does it take to change someone else's mind? How willing or how likely are you to change your own mind? Think back to a time when you did and tell us what was behind it. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest is Howard Gardner. He's a professor of cognition and education at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. He's written some 20 books. His latest is called Changing Minds. Welcome to the studio.
Thanks, Dick. Good to be here again.
I wonder if we could begin with Margaret Thatcher, because after leading us through the mechanics, once you plug a real person into the idea of changing minds, it was for me as if a light bulb went on. And I don't know, I mean, that may be just a layman's reading of the theory, but why did you choose her as the sort of strong example of changing minds?
For two different reasons in the book. First of all, if we think about leaders of democracies in the last 50 years, I can't think of anybody who brought about as profound a mind change as did Margaret Thatcher in Britain in the 1980s. After the Second World War, there was a bipartisan consensus in Britain that Britain was going to be happy to be a second-rate power with a kind of moderate socialism, a lot of nationalized industries, that Britain would sort of sit in the background and let other countries take the lead. And Margaret Thatcher thought this was all wrong. She thought that Britain wasn't working. In fact, she said Britain is not working, and there was a lot of unemployment there. She herself had a very different story, as I say, that Britain used to be a great country, a world leader, powerful, entrepreneurial, respected all over the world. And there was no reason except for will that Britain couldn't do that again. And defying pundits from all across the spectrum, within 5 or 6 years, the whole battleship of Britain had changed at least 45 or 90, if not 180 degrees. In fact, the best evidence of how powerful a mind change that Margaret Thatcher brought about is that even now, 15 years after she left office, people are still talking about Thatcherite policies, right. And Blair is talking about the third way. So number one is, I think, if you're writing a book about changing minds, you need to have a very dramatic example. The other is that they argue in the book that you can account for most mind changing through one of seven different factors, all of which happen to begin with the letters R-E. And Margaret Thatcher is a good example because, in fact, I think you can see all seven of the R-E factors at work she did.
Just before we get to that, I want to sort of remind our listeners a little bit of the tone of this woman and the power that she had to use to exercise this kind of mind changing. She was elected in 1979, and this is a little bit of Margaret Thatcher speaking at the party conference in Brighton 1 year later.
Those who urge us to relax the squeeze, to spend yet more money indiscriminately in the belief that will help the unemployed and the small businessman, are not being kind or compassionate or caring. I have only one thing to say. You turn if you want to. The ladies not for turning.
Margaret Thatcher from, gosh, that's almost 25 years ago. Hard to imagine that as you say, Howard, the power and the presence of the woman remained so strong. There's something about the narrative that she presents, which is an important way that you describe how it is she got people to pay attention. What is it about the story, the narrative?
If you're dealing with what I call a heterogeneous population, the way any leader of a polity would be, and certainly a country as large as Great Britain, you need to be able to talk in ways that ordinary people can understand. And stories happen to be the way that human beings talk to one another, unless we are quite sophisticated and use theories or equations or things like that. And the narrative that Margaret Thatcher told basically said that there was a bad way of doing things, a wrong way, and that Britain had followed that way for the past 20 or 30 years, whether it was conservative or a Labour government. Mm-hmm. But that at this point, if Britain didn't want to just sink into obscurity, it had to follow a very different road, a road which rejected socialistic ideas, gave free play to market forces. And the amazing thing was not only did she tell the story very well, this lady's not for turning, a clever turn of phrase because it's a play on a British drama, that
right.
not perhaps well known here, but also because she embodied that story in her own life. In other words, it wasn't somebody who gave her a script and said, here, Prime Minister Thatcher, read this. She was a woman who came from poverty. Her father was a grocer and she lived above his grocery. She got 2 degrees on her own, one in chemistry, one in law. Before she went into elective politics, she raised some kids. And so this wasn't somebody who was sort of to the manner born. This was somebody who showed that she, too, using her own wits, had been tremendously successful. I hardly need to add that she was a woman in a right. country which is perhaps even more chauvinistic than ours. And to think of a woman in elective office in America 25 years ago saying, turn if you want, I am not for turning. That's an incredibly powerful statement. But everybody who listened to Margaret Thatcher knew that she meant it.
And if we go back to that time, I mean, there's no question, Howard, that she changed the country. But how did she change minds? I mean, she made a lot of enemies, but was she also changing minds?
Oh, I think so. I think in any country you have kind of a central tendency, which is where most of the people who are not extremists find themselves. That's true in our country now. That's why we have such an evenly divided polity about the presidential election. And so when I talk about changing minds, I'm not talking about the people who were extreme socialists, you know,
right.
who were born
still fighting
in a red blanket, right?
Right?
And I'm not talking about people who were unreconstructive Milton Friedmanites, or whatever the British equivalent, Hayek was her own hero. I'm talking about people who said, you know, things have been pretty good under Harold Wilson and under James Callaghan and under Edmund Heath, and we really want to change. And she repeated the story in all sorts of different ways. She had great cartoons. She had great dramas. She had people supporting her very, very enthusiastically, as you could hear at the Congress. And what happened over time is that things that people were dubious of became more and more acceptable to them. So she moved the dialogue and what we would call the ways that people thought about the political scene. I mean, the best example in America would be someone like Ronald Reagan, who, of course, came in about the same time. I have always felt that Reagan had some deep beliefs like Thatcher, but perhaps the emphasis was somewhat more on the histrionics and somewhat less on the actual embodying the story of what he was talking about in his own life. And Margaret Thatcher was opportunistic in the sense that she quickly made friends with Reagan, and the fact that the United States and Britain were both moving somewhat to the right was helpful to her. But where Margaret Thatcher stands out is when Gorbachev first came on the scene, she was the first leader to sense that he was different from the other leaders in the former Soviet Union. She said, you can do business with this guy. And that was a very, very important turning point. And I think there's a place where she actually moved Reagan to be more accepting of Gorbachev.
You also mark the famous Nixon checkers speeches as a time when a politician used that pulpit, used that radio and television moment to change some minds. This is, let's see, where do we end up? September 1952, Nixon's in an election campaign as vice president. He's been accused of operating with an $18,000 slush fund. Wouldn't rent a limo for 3 days today, but it gets him in a lot of trouble. Let's listen to a little bit of what Vice President Nixon said.
And so now what I am going to do, and incidentally, this is unprecedented in the history of American politics, I am going at this time to give to this television and radio audience a complete financial history. Everything I've earned, everything I've spent, everything I owe. And I want you to know the facts.
Actually, it was Senator Nixon at that point, if I'm not mistaken. But
then
he does that. He goes on and he talks about how big his mortgage is and how much he pays virtually for groceries. Why is that a moment that you would mark as a mind-changing moment, Howard?
Well, first of all, I think this was the first time that a politician went to the airwaves, radio or television, to talk about something personal in a way of sort of going over the head of what we would now call the pundits. Mm-hmm. And we've since seen this happen with Bill Clinton more than once, and more recently with Howard Dean and Judith Steinberg.
Right.
So we might say it was politics as confessional. But I'm old enough to have actually remembered that speech. And the power of what Nixon did was incredible. Eisenhower was a world hero. World War hero. He was the head of the ticket. He didn't really much like Nixon, but Nixon was put on because he came from California, the other side of the country, and because he was known as an anti-communist, and that would please the people who were further to the right than Eisenhower. And Eisenhower was prepared to get rid of Nixon. And Nixon basically outflanked him. He said, I intend to go on television. I've bought the time, and I'm going to simply tell my story. And he went on television, and even though we now think of him as Tricky Dick, and he was tricky even then, he wasn't at all a well-known commodity by the American people at that time. And what he did was he defined himself. He said, you've heard these things about me. You've heard that I'm spoiled, or I'm fanatical, or I'm in somebody else's hand. But let me tell you the way it really is. And he talked about his family, his wife, his dog Checkers. That's why it's called the Checkers speech. He said, my wife doesn't have a fur coat. She's a good Republican cloth coat. We're not going to get rid of the dog because the dog means something to my kids, who probably they were there in photographic forms. And he totally humanized it. In my terms, he totally reframed the discussion. It was no longer about this clever Paul who had a sludge fund. It was about like a person like you and me who'd been besmirched and finally had this once-in-a-lifetime chance to tell the story right. And what happened the next day, Dick, is that the Republican Party was deluged by telegrams and by, there was no internet, of course, then, by telephone calls. And I doubt it was really orchestrated because it would have been too difficult to orchestrate it. It came all over the country. And Eisenhower realized he had no choice. Not only did Nixon run in 52, he ran in 56, even after Eisenhower said, if you give me a week, I might be able to think of something that Nixon helped me with. And when he was defeated in 1960, Nixon quit politics. He ran for governor, and he said, I'm not going to run again. But then he was able to reinvent himself, and he became president in 1968. And in thinking about Nixon, I remember what John Kenneth Galbraith, the Harvard economist, said. He said when Nixon was elected in 1968, it was obvious that Nixon wanted to be the president so much that obviously he was going to get it sooner or later, and we may as well get it over with. And it is true that Nixon was not even as likable as Margaret Thatcher, who I would not say was that likable. But there was something about his persistence, and I would say his genius at gauging where the center of America was, which made him so successful he could probably run again today and be elected.
When we come back after the break, we're going to talk about some of those seven REs, reason, research, resonance, redescriptions, concepts of the way that we actually change our mind. We'd also like to have you in on the conversation on some simple levels. How do you change your mind? What does it take to change your mind? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Support for NPR.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My guest this hour is Howard Gardner, professor of cognition and education at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, author of a number of books. The latest one is called Changing Minds, The Art and Science of Changing Our Own and Other People's Minds. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. If you'd like us to change your mind, just give us a call. We'll certainly fix you up. We want to listen to one more little bit of audio reminders of reminder of someone who was particularly powerful at changing minds, someone who I think, as Professor Gardner would say, is even outside that realm, almost above that realm of someone who is changing the minds for people only in one particular country. And for this, we have to go back to 1931, October 17th, when Mahatma Gandhi was a guest at Kingsley Hall and was recorded there. It's a little bit scratchy, but worth listening to the man himself.
I can see that in the midst of death, life persists. In the midst of untruth, truth persists. In the midst of darkness, light persists. Hence I gather that God is life, truth, light. He is love. He is the supreme good.
What was that man's particular skill at changing so many minds?
Well, I was actually thinking of this in comparison to what we heard on the other hour of the program.
Oh, Stephen Flynn.
Yes, about terrorism. And if you want to bring about change and you don't have the same power as the people who have hegemony, one way to do it is to do it through terror. Gandhi was really the first person certainly in the last millennium, who developed a whole method for trying to change people's minds, the minds of your adversaries peacefully. The method that he invented, Satyagraha, or truth force, was basically a method whereby you showed what it is that you wanted and were willing to be civilly disobedient, to confront your antagonists without weapons, to fast, and if necessary, to go to your death unarmed, because what you believed in so strongly that you felt it was worth giving your life for. And as anybody knows who either has read history or saw the way we now learn history, the Ben Kingsley movie, Gandhi did this over and over again in his life. He led marches to the sea, salt marches with thousands of people, many of whom were willing to be shot down in cold blood by the adversary British forces. He went on many, many fasts to the death in order to bring about a change that he thought was important for the people of India. And not only did he succeed in helping to forge an independent India, but the example of Gandhi had tremendous influence on civil disobedience in the United States. Both Martin Luther King Jr. and his advisor Bayard Rustin were very, very influenced by Gandhi. Nelson Mandela in South Africa was again influenced by Gandhi. And in 1989, the Tiananmen incident in Beijing, the one solitary young man who confronted the tank was again showing that there's something more powerful than having weapons, and that's the power of naked truth, simply saying, I believe this is right, I'm willing to take the consequences. And as far as I'm concerned, Gandhi is the most important thinker and doer and beer of the last millennium, because if we're not going to blow up ourselves as a whole planet, it's going to be because enough people understand Gandhi's message, both method and message. Is it a long shot? Of course, but as far as I'm concerned, it's the only way of preserving some kind of sanity in our planet.
So when we go back into that list of words that you give us to help us understand what factors come to play in changing people's minds? I mentioned earlier reason and research, the sort of why would you do it and what are the details. But as I listen to you describe Gandhi's skill, then we get into the more affective way of changing people's minds, and that's the resonance. Does it feel right? And that would be probably at the top of the list, would it not, when you're describing his skill?
Well, let me work backwards, Dick, if I could.
Yeah.
I think most people, if we ask how do you change somebody's mind, would either say, well, we reward or punish. And I always say, as a parent, when all else fails, I become a behaviorist. And of course, you do change behavior through reward and punishment, but you very, very change people's minds, because as soon as you remove the reward or punishment, we go back to where we were before. If we are academics or scholars, and many people who listen to National Public Radio would be convinced by this, we tend to use reason, argument, mm-hmm. or we tend to use research. And Gandhi was certainly not averse to using argument, and he wasn't averse to using research about poverty and about colonialization and things like that. But what I try to do in changing minds is to bring attention to four other factors, which I think are not paid attention to as much. One of them, which you mentioned, is resonance. Resonance is, does this feel right? When somebody says this, even if I can't consciously give an articulated reason, in my gut, does this seem to make sense? And even though to Churchill, Gandhi looked like a half-naked fakir, he didn't look that way to most of the people in right. India. He looked like an incredibly sincere person who was very much on their wavelength. A second thing, which has a kind of a daunting titled Representational Redescription means making the same point over and over again in as many different ways as possible. Gandhi could talk. We heard the recording of him in English. But he represented what he believed much more by the symbolic things he kind of did, like marching to the sea.
His fasting.
Yeah. The way he dressed, his cultivation of the spinning
right.
wheel, the way in which he lived. There's a joke which was known at the time, which is it cost a lot of money to keep Gandhi in poverty because, of course, he had to have press around and telegrams and things like that, but he lived an exemplary life of the ascetic, exactly. So representational redescription is another powerful lever. A third one, which I think we don't think about enough, is real-world events. What is happening in the world today which really changes our chance of getting across what we want to do? Gandhi actually supported Britain for a while during the First World War. But then he somehow realized that this was not going to work as a long-time solution. And the First World War, in a sense, and the weakening of Britain thereafter, gave him an entry point toward being more independent. Again, the same thing in the Second World War. He, again, did not openly oppose Britain initially, but the weakening of Britain, again, gave him an open. So it's taking advantage of things that you can't really control. He certainly
right.
had no control over the wars. The final one is, if you said to me, what's the single reason that people fail to change minds as often as we would like, it's underestimating the power of resistance. Because most of us have lived for most of our lives thinking one way about something. And in order to overcome that, we really have to undo those neural networks which could have fired for 20, 30, or 40 years in one direction and move them in another kind of way. And not only, let's take Britain as the opponent of Gandhi, not only did Gandhi have to convince people from a very different background that rather than India just being a very successful colony, it should be an independent nation, but he had to convince them that he wasn't going to do that through warfare, just like Nelson Mandela brought about peace in South Africa with way, way less bloodshed than anybody could have imagined. So this is why I think, you know, for whatever we could say about Margaret Thatcher and Richard Nixon or Bill Clinton or Newt Gingrich, these are adequate mind changers. Gandhi ranks with the great religious leaders of the last millennia.
All right, our number is 1-800-423-8255. You have your checklist now, Connection listeners. Let's put some of the mind-changing to work on the phones. We're going to go first to North Andover, Massachusetts, and Martina is joining us. Hi, Martina.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm just very much interested in this subject with regard to changing minds and something that has happened, you know, so recently as September 11th and the tragedy of that. And in relation to your speaker's comments, how that might have changed the minds of American people with regard to that the world is a bigger place, that it's larger than, you know, beginning on the East Coast and ending on the West Coast or whatever, and with regard to speaking out, that we as citizens have to, you know, what is happening in the world, you're saying, your speaker is saying today. The Palestinian issue is a huge issue, and we need to ask ourselves, you know, what can we, you know, we must speak out, and, you know, the Iraqi issue, you're talking about Mandela and Gandhi bringing about change without warfare. And it's something that is not overseas. It's been brought to the shores here.
I'll stop you there, if you don't mind, Martina, just so I can let Howard in on this. But nobody set out to... No, I guess I'm wrong. I was going to say nobody set out to change somebody's mind, but in fact, that's exactly what happened, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think that there's one situation where the mind was clearly changed, and that is the notion of American vulnerability. We used to say that God takes care of widows, orphans, and the United States of America, and in this particular case, God let us down. However, the bigger question, which Martina is touching on, is what do we do with that event? What's the narrative that we then substitute? And I'm afraid, and it's hard not to be somewhat political here, that we regressed right away to a narrative of us against them. We're the good guys. The other people are bad guys. It was a replay of the Cold War or, for that matter, of the Second World War.
But it was framed for people that way by the political leaders.
Absolutely. And it's very tempting to frame it that way, because, of course, the people who blew us up were very bad guys. I think about this all the time, most recently in the last hour when you were talking to the security expert. And I think what one needs is, to be frank, a much better storyteller than George Bush, who can tell a more complex narrative, a narrative which talks about certainly we need to be secure, and certainly the people who are making trouble in Iraq nowadays, or who blew up the trains in Madrid, need to be brought to justice. But we need to be thinking in terms of much longer time relationships between us and the rest of the world, about poverty, about tolerance. And as long as we put it in a good guy versus bad guy, or they're fundamentalists and we're not perspective, we're just going to exacerbate things. As Daniel Shore said in a clip for NPR, you know, the Spanish election was won by Al-Qaeda. It wasn't won by George Bush.
So if we look at the news of the last couple of weeks, when Richard Clark, with the release of his book Against All Enemies, received so much attention, it occurred to me to mention that in today's conversation, because I was wondering whether or not he got that attention, Howard, because he was changing minds, or whether or not he was offering a narrative that affirmed what a lot of people wanted to have affirmed, not so much changing minds as offering that kind of evidence that people might not have had who were perhaps already opposed to the war in Iraq. How do you look at that?
Yeah, I think except for something like September 11th, a single book by a single person is not likely going to have that big effect. I mean, we have to go back to Uncle Tom's Cabin, perhaps, or Mein Kampf. But what does happen, and again, it's this notion of central tendency. If a number of things happen, first David Kaye gives his report, right, then Richard Clark writes his book, we have Condoleezza Rice's testimony to look forward to this Thursday. If they all begin to look like basically we were given a line that they weren't weapons of mass destruction, that on September 12th the decision was really made to go to war against Iraq because of a grudge that was held by Bush and his closest associates, then I do think minds change. But here's where the issue of resistance is so important. Richard Nixon said something inelegant but very true. He said, when you've said something so often that you're about ready to throw up, he said, that's about the time that the American people are ready to believe it. Now, what Nixon, if I were cleaning up, what Nixon was really saying is people have to hear things a lot in a lot of different ways if right. their minds are going to be changed. I knew that Michael Dukakis, our one-time governor of Massachusetts, lost the 1988 election when he was asked a question at a press conference. He said, oh, I answered that in Minnesota. You cannot politically say something once and expect it to have a change. Right. I think both Bill Clinton and Tony Blair are very good storytellers, and they can tell the same story in a number of different ways. And over time, that does change the central tendency. But as I mentioned in the book, Changing Minds, the problem with Clinton was that he really had too many stories. He told them all well and wasn't clear which one he believed the most. Here's where the distinction with Thatcher is so clear. It was absolutely obvious to everybody what the story was that Thatcher believed in with her every essence of her being.
1-800-423-8255. Now, a warning, Connection listeners, we're not going to spend the entire hour talking about modern-day politics and terrorism. We're talking about changing minds. We won't allow you in on that. But before we leave world politics, a call from Maynard, Massachusetts, and Rick's with us. Hi, Rick. What are you thinking?
Hi. Have you determined in your discussion yet, you know, what is the main factor that's important for changing minds of world opinion?
Let me take Rick's question. I talk in Changing Minds about seven different factors, all of which begin with the letters R-E. That helps you remember them. And I think of everybody as having a quiver with seven different arrows in it, and those are the seven R-E's, reason, resonance, representational description, and so on. If you are a good archer, you pick the right arrow for this particular occasion. If you're a teacher, for example, I think the arrow of representational redescription, namely being able to say the same thing in many, many different ways, is the most powerful arrow. If you are dealing with a lover or somebody with whom you're very close, I think resonance, being on the same wavelength, is the most powerful arrow. If you are a creator, somebody doing something very innovative, then knowing what the resistances are, knowing if you're Darwin or Einstein or Picasso, what most people expect, and being able to punctuate those resistances, that's the most powerful arrow that you have. And the fun of writing the book Changing Minds is I went all the way from people like Gandhi or Hitler, who had huge mind-changing impact all over the world, to the solitary mind changing that takes place in George Bush after September 11th, or the American political figure Whitaker Chambers, who was a communist who became an anti-communist, or between Eric Erickson, the therapist, and his patient, who was able to reconsider who he was and become a renewed individual. I actually have a discussion of famous discussion at Harvard between Larry Summers, the president, and Cornel West, a faculty member in the department, about changing minds, between Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, who changed each other's minds during the last part of their careers.
Let me bring you just back briefly, and we've only got about a minute till we have to take a break. But the Darwin example is an interesting one, because that's a kind of mind changing which doesn't happen like that. It happens over a period of time, and that's a little bit different from what we've been talking about in politics.
Right. I call that indirect leadership, because Darwin didn't talk directly to anybody. In fact, he rarely talked to anybody. He wrote something. He wrote something in words. Picasso makes a painting. Einstein writes E equals MC squared. And either it gets noticed or not by the leaders. And it often takes years, even decades, in the case of people like Van Gogh or Bach, for these people really to bring about the mind change. So leadership mind changes typically occur more rapidly or not at all. Those by people who are highly creative can take centuries. In fact, it took a century for Darwin's ideas to be accepted even in the sciences. And in this country alone, 80% of people are still very skeptical about evolution, though that's not, of course, the scientific community, which by and large accepts it in all its fundamental facets.
1-800-423-8255, Connection listeners. That's the hour to, or the number to join our conversation this hour. I'm here with Howard Gardner. We're talking about his new book, Changing Minds, The Art and Science of Changing Our Own and Other People's Minds. Do you actually think, when you're out to change somebody's mind, how you're going to do it, or do you just launch into it? 1-800-423-TALK is the number. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Support for National Public.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. We do it every day, set out to change somebody's mind. It might be a little argument. Do we turn left? Do we turn right? Are we going to buy that house? Are we not going to buy that house? How do you change your own mind? How do you change someone else's? Well, Howard Gardner is here with me in the studio to talk about it. He's got a book out on that very subject. He's a professor of cognition and education at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. Our number is 1-800-423-TALK. We'd like to have you join us. Let's go next to Pete, who's calling in from Canton, Massachusetts. Hi, Pete.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine, thanks for calling.
Great show. Obviously, your guest has done a lot of good thinking on this. I would like to say a couple things that are probably implicit in what you gentlemen have done, but I think need to be said and tie some of the comments from your callers. And that is, on the resistance front, you're dealing with people who start with a belief system. And I think in today's age, the 9/11 issue is a good example. Believing and knowing, having facts, is a big difference. And if you believe that the United States is invulnerable, that's a pretty dangerous idea to have. And then when 9/11 happens, you have something new, which is a fact. And to answer your question, Dick, you know, what convinces me when somebody's trying to change my mind, it's facts. I really don't care what the beliefs are. I don't care what your resonance is. I don't care how hard you say it, how many times you say it. I work off facts, and I think maybe that's his research of the seven that he's listed. And I would just like to open...
Hang on a second. Pete, yeah, don't go in here. Let's let Howard in here, and then we'll go to the second point.
You hit the nail on the head. This is real world... And it's research. This is something that happened in the real world. And as you say, it's a fact which is based upon research. The reason I wanted to interrupt at this point is because if I wanted to change Pete's mind, it would be a very important thing to know that Pete is very affected by what happens in the world and by reason. We think about Deborah Tannen's book, You Just Don't Understand, about how men and women often talk right past each other, because more men are like Pete. They want the facts, they want to know, and they want to make a decision. Women want to have somebody feel their pain and to know that you're on the same page affectively. I don't think, Pete, you would be very successful with some women who I won't mention by name who are looking for very different kinds of things. And this is the key for the listeners. We need to know what changes our own mind, but we also need to know if we want to change somebody else's mind, what's the right key? And
but
the
that's
key
a nice
for
segue to the issue of manipulation and propaganda. And I think in this dangerous time, what I think it's very important for people to understand is that some of the factors you're listing, and that's why I think you've done some good thinking on this, are factors which should not be so influential. They are, you're right, and I can be very unsuccessful with somebody who doesn't give a damn about facts. but I think it's very important in this day and age when a mistake like 9/11 happens and everybody says, oh, who knew, that in fact when you find out there were people tracking these guys, there were people thinking about this kind of disaster, that now you realize what is the danger of having the wrong belief. So I'd love you to comment on not just what changes people's minds, but of that list that you have, the danger, and maybe this should be even be taught in schools, of propaganda. You mentioned the Hitler era, the masters of propaganda. I think it's important to know some of the tools you've listed because it's frightening to believe that somebody can change their mind merely because of the way something is postured, delivered, rather than the merits.
Yeah, you're raising the whole issue, Pete, about the relationship between inquiry or science on the one hand and policy or what we should do on the other. And as a scholar, I have to study mind changing without regard to whether I liked it or the kind or not. I remember when I began to study Margaret Thatcher, my wife said, well, why do you want to study her? She's such an awful person. And I said, well, I don't know if she's an awful person, but you can't understand mind changing unless you understand Margaret Thatcher. Then when you wear the hat about how would I want to educate people and how would I want to put them on their alert, I do think that exposing the tools that people have, including the tools of manipulation, is really the best way to neutralize them. I was talking earlier with Dick Gordon about talk radio. And we might make a distinction, I haven't been paid by NPR to say this, between the talk radio which preaches to the converted. We'll compare Rush Limbaugh on the one hand and Al Franken on the other. They're probably unlikely to change too many people's minds because basically they're throwing raw meat to the listeners. And something like, let's say, the editorial page of a major newspaper or something like national, not the op-ed page of a major newspaper or something like National Public Radio, where you attempt to bring a variety of points of view to bear, and you can kind of encourage the listener to make up his own mind, her own mind. I've often listened to NPR on a topic that I don't have very strong opinions on, and I actually see my mind changing over the course of an hour. I see there's a lot more sense to this than I had thought. Now, the crucial test, if you come back to me a week later, will I have completely forgotten this? Will I have been say, well, I remember this, but I'm not convinced? Well, I actually begin to ease over to say, well, maybe I need to pay more attention to this guy, Stephen Flynn, next time he writes something, because he's really got a point about our putting all the eggs in the airport basket and nothing about our vulnerable seaports.
Can I ask you, though, early on in the book, you make the point, and you alluded to it earlier in the program today, that changing minds is really only about changing behavior, if I'm misstating this, I'll get you to correct me. But it left me wondering, if you listen to something on the radio and you go, huh, that's a different way of thinking of something, you have in a way changed your mind, but it may not have changed your behavior. So is understanding a real mind change only interpreted by when you do something differently? I write a check to the other party or...
Yeah, you've read me very carefully, Dick. I think that if, in fact, you believe that your mind has been changed on something, but in fact you continue to behave exactly the way you did before, then you're basically fooling yourself. However, it doesn't mean that you write the check the next day. What happens, ironically, is you often you behave differently and you realize that your mind has in fact changed and you didn't know about it. You read those editorials, you listened to the radio, you talked to a friend, and all of a sudden you find yourself doing something you'd never done before, and you say, my goodness, I really changed my mind about that. And the opening example of the book, Nicholson Baker, as a writer, has this idea of this fantastic change of his apartment. And 5 years later, he realizes he never changed his apartment. And he realizes he never made a decision not to. But over the course of things, the way that his mind and his brain settled, resulted in the decision not to change his apartment.
We're going to go back to the calls. 1-800-423-8255. And we're in Newton, Massachusetts with Debbie. Debbie, thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. I'm a big fan of Mr. Gardner there. You're kind of touching on one of my interests in particular, and it seems to be that there's kind of a fine line of where someone is changing your mind or when you actually change your own mind. I'm not sure quite where
it's a good question. Can someone change your mind, or do you have to do it yourself based on their persuasion? Is that it, Debbie?
Well, that's kind of what I'm kind of interested in.
Whoop.
More so, I'm sorry, even more so, real interested in how consciously change one's own mind. Here's a couple of simple graphic examples. If someone's raised as a racist, they know they're adult now, they know intellectually being a racist is wrong, but they can't seem to make that shift. They can't seem to shift that judgment or the view that one's a failure. And they intellectualize, they see that they've succeeded in certain things and some things they're good at and other things they're not, but they can't seem to break out of that that decision about themselves.
All right, let's put
people,
that across.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Let's hear from Howard on that. That's a good question.
Very sensitively put. I think in the West, we tend to overestimate the amount of self-agency we have, and we probably arrogate to ourselves more of the role in our own mind changing, which than is actually the case. In East Asia, say Japan, for example, I think people probably underestimate the extent to which they actually contribute to their own mind changing by their reading and thinking, and may attribute too much to what the group does or what a powerful leader does. That said, I think that the situation you're describing is somebody who would like to have the mind changed, but in fact, at a fundamental level, hasn't really changed his or her mind. And alas, because social psychology is very powerful now, it can often reveal that while we think we're not racist anymore, that at a deeper level we are. We probably can't control that totally, but what we can't control is our behavior. And if we try to behave in such a way that our racism is minimized, that's certainly better than fooling ourselves into thinking that we really are not racist at all. The example you used is something actually I spend a lot of time on the book, and that's the example of fundamentalism. I think fundamentalism is a fascinating phenomenon, and it exists in every sphere of life, not simply in religion. Fundamentalism is the decision that a person makes consciously not to change his or her mind about something. In religion, you say, I'm not going to change.
You can be a fundamentalist about smoking or eating or driving habits.
You can be a fundamentalist about anything.
Okay.
I mean, I'm a fundamentalist about science. I basically think that not all questions can be answered by science, but any question that can be, that's the way that we should approach it. It would be extremely difficult to get me to change my mind about that. The example that writers on this topic often use is Saul on the road to Damascus,
right.
The Damascene experience, where you think that something suddenly happens and your mind has been changed forever. I think that almost never happens, though the erupting into consciousness can be sudden. Darwin believed that he came up with the theory of evolution when he had read Malthus about how too many people were competing for too little space and it was survival of the fittest. In fact, if you go through Darwin's notebooks, you see he was playing with those ideas many, many times before, but it took a dramatic event of reading Malthus to break things into consciousness. I imagine that's even true about September 11th, that in one way, people, of course, know that any country is vulnerable. Pearl Harbor, the shelling of Baltimore in 1814, but it doesn't erupt into consciousness until there's some kind of a trigger.
Let's go back to the lines, 1-800-423-8255. And Jennifer's with us from Milton, Massachusetts. Hi, Jennifer.
Yes, thanks so much for calling or for
Thank you for calling. Nice to have you here.
I'm also a big fan of Mr. Gardner's work, and it does seem like there's almost a philosophical or humanistic thread that runs through all of your work. I'm wondering how and what you would like to change people's minds about through your work.
it sounds like this is a question made in heaven. For the last 10 years, with a close group of colleagues, I've been studying what I call good work. And we have a project called the Good Work Project, and the website is, in fact, goodworkproject.org. In the Good Work Project, we're trying to understand how people can do work that's excellent in quality, but at the same time it's socially responsible, work that's ethical, work that takes into account its wider implications. The trigger is the belief, which to some extent we could blame on Margaret Thatcher, that markets are the best thing for regulating every sphere of life. I have no objection to markets. I'm a beneficiary of markets. But I don't believe medical care or legal protection or education should only go to people who can afford it. Yet as long as we believe that everything is best decided by supply and demand, we're going to have a society in this country and, alas, elsewhere, where only the people who are well-heeled will be well-treated. The goal of the Good Work Project is to figure out how it is that ordinary people like us and extraordinary people like Nelson Mandela or Mahatma Gandhi or Martin Luther King Jr. can manage to do things which are both excellent in quality, technical, creative, intelligent, but at the same time take into account the wider good and don't expect that God's going to intervene because God knows what's right, but that we're going to try to do it ourselves with whatever help, divine and non-divine, that we can find. I'm inspired by Margaret Mead, who said, never condemn a small group of people who got together to start discussing something new. Nothing important in the world has ever happened any other way. And I'm interested in people who are willing to think about things that are different than the way they are now and to take the first step in doing it.
I suspect you're fairly good at changing people's minds when it comes to that. Mr. Gardner, I want to thank you so much for being with us on the program today.
Thank you, Dick, and thanks especially to Jennifer for that wonderful question.
Howard Gardner, professor of cognition and education at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, author of a new book called Changing Minds, the Art and Science of Changing Our Own and Other People's Minds. Our program is produced by Catherine Fenollosa, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Support for NPR comes from NPR State.